actions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by Merit System Protection Board Chairman Susan Grunman. You'll also hear Jason Fornicola's interviews with AFGE 6th District National Vice President Arnold Scott, author Andrew McAfee, and Hooks Book Events President Perry Hooks. Welcome to Inside Government.
Hey, Ward, how are you doing?
Good. So let's start off by telling us, what is the Merit System Protection Board?
Well, under our statute, we have three primary missions. The first is to adjudicate cases within our jurisdiction. And what would be interesting to your viewers are those types of cases are adverse actions, suspensions more than 14 days, removals, RIFs. We also hear cases on Hatch Act violations and whistleblower claims, to name a few. Our second statutory function is something that's little known and it's not really very much used, but it allows us to review OPM regulations and agency implementation of those regulations to prevent prohibited personnel practices from occurring. And the final authority that we have is to conduct studies on the health and well-being of the civil service system and report to Congress and to report to the President. Some of our recommendations have become the basis of statutory or regulatory reform.
And would you say those are the three missions of the board?
Absolutely.
And do you work in conjunction with any other agencies, or are you sort of a standalone judiciary?
That's a good question, because we are, by statute, an independent agency and considered quasi-judicial in nature. When I talked about the adverse actions, the cases that we adjudicate, they're heard by 60 judges in the field and in headquarters, and they're conducted pursuant to rules. There's discovery, and there, in some cases, is an actual hearing that comes out of it, and appeals come to the board in Washington, D.C.
Now, you all have a very good website in terms of information around that, because I know a lot of times it may be AFG people get in a situation where they're either representing or they have a case before the MSPB or the judges, and there's a lot of specific things people need to know in terms of deadlines and stuff like that.
Yes, absolutely. What the judges will do is once the case is first, in terms of timeliness, you have to file in a timely fashion or have a really, really, really good reason why you haven't. And the board's case law is fairly strict to that effect. But the tools are there. It's Q&A. We're constantly revising that website to give people more tools. What we're looking at in the future is providing maybe sample discovery, since a lot of our appellants are pro se, about 50% of them are pro se, so you want to be able to familiarize them with the tools of our trade. So sample discovery, forms perhaps, things to expect.
And let's talk a little about something that happened recently. I understand you all hosted some representatives of good government advocacy groups.
That's right. That's something, it's interesting because when we came on board, so to speak, the President signed into effect the Open Government Transparency Directive for all federal agencies. And it requires a number of things, but we've taken that to heart in the sense that we are now reaching out on a continual basis to all our stakeholders. This started off in the early spring. We met with the union representatives. We met with AFGE, along with a number of other representatives. We've met with the agency representatives. We've met with the private plaintiffs bar. Good government folks were on about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And next week we'll be meeting with the managers' associations.
And what do you expect to be the result of all this?
We're hearing lots of interesting things. One about what's good about our practice, our process, and where we can improve. Our timeliness, is it good? Is it some of the features that we have in the past that have implemented, such as the initial disclosures that occur at the outset of the filing of the case, whether those are useful, whether we should get rid of them altogether? I mean, the input's been fabulous, and I think in terms of growing the agency and making us a more effective agency that serves our stakeholders, this is the right thing to do. I mentioned the groups that we've met with. Our goal is that once we meet with these agencies, we follow up with a letter, action items that we've taken, and we'll come back to the same groups sometime next year. So it's going to be an ongoing series of discussions.
As the outgrowth of any of this, are you finding that there's maybe more of a need for alternative dispute resolution? I mean, you all kind of do adjudicatory things, but is there any need for maybe more mediation type access?
That's a good question, because we have something that we call a MAP program in the regional level, the initial filing stage. The cases can also, the parties can self-refer, or the judge may flag it. And those cases go into some sort of a resolution mode. In the past, our settlement at the regional level and the field level has been about 50%. Recently, it's up to, I think the last numbers that we saw were about 68% actually settled in the field. At headquarters, there's also a dispute resolution mechanism. It's a little harder in the sense that by the time you come to headquarters, one party's already won and one party's already lost. So the incentive to go into that program is not quite as strong as a regional and field level.
And let's talk about some of the other studies that the MSPB does. I guess the most recent one deals with first-level supervisors?
Yeah, that was just released late last week. It's called A Call to Action, Improving First-Level Supervision of Federal Employees. It's a fabulous report, because what it does is it recognizes that the first-level supervisors are not only critical, but becoming a first-level supervisor is a major career change. And perhaps agencies are not doing all they could to prepare supervisors for that career change. In the past, supervisors have been selected based on their technical ability and their technical expertise rather than on their ability to supervise individuals, which is a separate skill set altogether. And we make a series of recommendations along those lines, steps agencies can consider taking in improving the first-level supervisor.
I know one of the really fascinating things to me about the MSPB has always been this ability to do some research and studies. I mean, adjudicatory functions are always there in various levels for courts and everywhere else, but you all get to really develop a research agenda. Can you tell us some of the things that might be on that?
We're in the process of doing that right now, and we put out a call to all the people that we've brought in as stakeholders, plus the folks that we've always reached out to traditionally, and asked you guys what you think it's appropriate or best for us to study. And we take that list, and it's usually, hundreds and hundreds of topics. And our Office of Policy and Evaluation actually culls that list down and researches individual options. And they, I don't know how far the list they're going to bring down. They can probably consolidate a number of items together. And they will bring them to the board, the three board members, and ask for our input on what are good topics to discuss. This year, when we go to the selection of those topics, the discussion has been, I think this is the route we're going to take, that we'll do that in the Sunshine Act meeting. So that discussion will occur in public.
And tell us a little more about the board in general. Who are some of the other people that serve on it with you?
All right. Coming on at the same time with me is the Vice Chair, Ann Wagner, who originally hails from AFGE, and again, it's a small world. I know she worked with you, Ward. She was an amici with me on a previous brief in my past life, and she started with me in November. We joined the existing member, Mary Rose, who is holdover from the last administration, a fabulous lady who has some OPM background and brings a lot of historical perspective to what we do here.
And tell us a little more about your background. I understand you have a very good background for this.
Well, you know, Ward, I remember it wasn't too long ago that the two of us were sitting side by side during some of those meet and confirm meetings at NSPS. So my background is I spent 20 years representing federal employees with federal labor unions, first with the National Air Traffic Controllers Association and then with NEFI. A lot of our work in the last, at least with NEFI during the last several years, has been fighting NSPS. And that's kind of where we got to know the larger labor community.
And tell us a little about the process of how you came to be chair of the MSPB.
The phone rings one day, and somebody asks you for a resume, and you send a resume, and then the phone rings again a couple of days later or a couple of weeks later, and you come in for an interview. It's an interesting process, but it's a multiple. It's interviews. It's vetting. And then there's the confirmation process, which is accompanied by pre-hearing questions, post-hearing questions from both the majority party and the ranking party, and then it's a Senate confirmation vote following that.
Okay, we're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government, and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. Purchase any laptop from July 15th through August 15th and receive a free custom skin. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
AFGE members are eligible for a 6% members-only discount.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Arnold Scott, AFGE's District 6 National Vice President. NVP Scott, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Jason. I'm happy to be here.
Now, we have a situation brewing in DFAS, that is the Defense Finance and Accounting Service. Tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Well, what's going on right now, Jason, is that Defense Finance and Accounting is terminating employees based upon their credit score. They go up on the online and they pull down the Equifax report and they look at the report and then they come back and tell these employees based on their report that somehow they are not trustworthy anymore, because just like most people in this economy, they're having a hard time. Government workers, just like everybody else, they're having a hard time, too. And, you know, based on their credit report, they are terminating these employees.
Now, as we understand it, there actually isn't a specific credit score criteria that DFAS is looking for, right? So this is a very subjective analysis.
That's right, Jason. What they tell us, I was in a meeting about 3 weeks ago, with the Defense Finance and Accounting and DOD, and they told us that they use 13 criteria. They haven't told us what the criteria are yet to determine whether they release these employees or not, but they say we look at the whole person. Well, when I sat down and I looked at the package, the only thing I see is the Equifax credit score. And based on that Equifax credit score, they are releasing these employees. Now, we all know that the Equifax credit score is not perfect. I mean, I've went through it myself a couple of times where things have been placed on my credit report that I didn't know. And, you know, these employees, the same thing are happening with them in some instances. They're disputing whether they owe this debt, and the government takes the position, we don't want to hear whether you're disputing it. We want you to pay the debt, and then you dispute it later.
And so that we have a little history here, when did this begin? Is this recent? Was this started years ago?
I believe, Jason, it started back in 2004, and it was when the Defense Finance and Accounting started downsizing and closing various sites, and they started moving employees from one place to another. You know, I'm glad you raised that issue up, because some of the sad things that's happening in this is you got employees that move from one place to another place, and then once they got where they were going, they ran the credit report, found out these people had bad credit, and they terminating these employees, and they don't even have a family support there or anything, a support system there, because they just left where they was living at and moved to a new place and don't have any family there.
So the agency offers them a position somewhere else, deems them qualified on the merits of their work, to transfer to a new location, have a new job, and then once they get there, credit report has been pulled and they're no longer qualified in the agency's eyes. Is that right?
That's exactly it, Jason.
So how many people have been affected so far?
You know, I really don't have the number on the total number of people that's been affected, because we've been trying to get that information from the Defense Finance and Accounting. We've put in information requests, and they're dragging their feet on providing us with the documentation that we need. But we do know that there's a new round of cuts that's happening, and it's affecting something like 33 people. We know that 10 of them are located in Indianapolis, 8 of them are located in Cleveland, and these are removals because there's only 21 removals out of those 33. The rest of those people are being placed on what they call indefinite suspension, which means that they take these employees, suspend them, and these employees don't get paid. They just sit out there on that suspension until DFAS decides that they want to terminate them or decide that they're going to let them come back to work. They're not receiving any pay. And then DFAS also challenges whether those employees get unemployment also. So this is a drastic situation.
So what we have here on the surface, according to the agency, is an issue related to personal debt.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not, as we understand it, looking at the type of debt. Does it matter if it's consumer debt through a credit card, buying a bunch of televisions or something like that, or maybe medical debt? That doesn't seem to be the issue, just the fact that they have the debt. And then if they're fired or placed on an indefinite suspension where they're not getting any pay, how does the debt get satisfied?
It doesn't get satisfied. It makes the situation worse because now you got an employee who's not receiving pay and can't pay their debtors. I think that these employees that we're talking about, Jason, these are hardworking, dedicated federal workers, and they do a great job for the American public. You know, I read an article probably about 3 weeks ago, and it talked about prisoners who have access to confidential information performing work for the federal government and other businesses. Social Security numbers, and they have access to Social Security numbers and all that type data. But, you know, somehow these dedicated federal workers who haven't committed a crime, the only thing they've done is, just like all Americans, they're having a tough time paying their bills. You know, they're saying, we can't trust you. But, you know, we got these prisoners in six different states that have access to this same information that they can't trust these dedicated federal workers for.
Workers that they hired.
Workers that they hired, and workers that's doing an outstanding job. I mean, a lot of these people are veterans, you know. They've served their country and served their country honorably.
And so that we understand it correctly, this isn't something based off of a poor performance review or a number of documented issues within the workplace that we know of. This is simply based on one's credit score. Is that right?
It's simply based on one credit score. In a couple of cases, individuals have filed appeals concerning these credit issues, and their cases were heard by an administrative law judge, an ALJ, and the judge came back and made a recommendation to DOD that these employees should be brought back and given their security clearances. And, you know, DOD, because the judge can only make a recommendation to DOD, DOD is kind of thumbing their nose at the judge and just saying, we're terminating these employees because of security.
And like you said, these are hardworking, trustworthy employees. You don't get into a position where you are processing the payroll checks and benefits for the president and members of the Marines and the Navy just overnight. You obviously, like you mentioned, they have to have security clearances and they go through background investigations. So these are worthy employees, right?
These are worthy employees. And Jason, you know, I just want to say one thing. I kind of feel like DFAS is being a little dishonest in what they're doing here, because when I was at a meeting up in Cleveland, they kept talking about these employees having access to Social Security numbers and access to the system. Well, we all know that it's on a need-to-know basis that access is granted within that system. It's like AFG's website, where you can go up to AFG.org and you can log in on the home page, but if you want to see something else, then you got to, if you want to go into the members only section, you got to have a password to get into that section. It's the same way with DFAS. Every employee does not have the same access into that system.
Sure.
And, you know, they're being dishonest saying that these employees have access to all of this information, because it's not true.
And so it's not as if there's a giant open book or database that everyone in the entire office can go through. It's you get there if you need to be there.
Right. It's on a need-to-know basis.
Now, you had discussed this also being an issue in Indianapolis in addition to Cleveland. Are there other places throughout the country that you know of, or are they just central to one or two places?
Well, when we met with DFAS and accounting services, I raised this issue starting probably about 3 years ago. And at that time, it was happening in Indianapolis at the Finance Center. And when we met with the Department of Defense and Defense Finance and Accounting, one of the issues they said is, we started this in Indianapolis, and as we went through the BRAC process, then we applied it to different places, and so they're moving it throughout the entire agency. It started in Indianapolis. It went from Indianapolis to Columbus. It went from there to Cleveland, you know, and as they shut down various facilities through the BRAC process, they've implemented it there.
So where do we go from here? I know that you have been working with the local out there, Local 3283, to try and get some resolution, but where do you think this is going?
Well, I think that we'd like to see a process where these employees have a fair appeal process, you know, where an administrative law judge or the Merit System Protection Board can sit down and hear these cases, and based upon these cases, make a ruling, and the Department of Defense has to abide by that ruling, something that's fair to the employees. We've been meeting with Congressman Kucinich. We've been meeting with Congresswoman Fudge out of Ohio. We've been meeting with Congressman La Tourette, meeting with Senator Sherrod Brown, and meeting with Congressman Carson out of Indiana to talk about this. As a matter of fact, that's the reason why I'm here today, to go to meetings with these various congressmen and senators to talk about the issue and see what it is that we can do, because AFG is committed. We're committed that we're going to fight to make sure that there's a fair process for these employees and that the wrong that's done to them is corrected.
We will certainly be keeping our eye on this one, and we do hope that you'll come back and update us on the outcome of the situation.
I'll be more than happy to do that, Jason.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Andrew McAfee, author of Enterprise 2.0, New Collaborative Tools for Your Organization's Toughest Challenges. Andrew is also the luncheon keynote speaker here at Government Executives Excellence in Government Conference. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So I just want to start off by getting a background on your book, Enterprise 2.0. You know, a lot of people obviously these days are interested in Web 2.0 and what's going on with the latest technologies. Tell us about your book, why you decided to write it.
Well, I started to hear this phrase, Web 2.0, about 5-6 years ago, and I was initially hugely skeptical because it's a pretty amazing claim that there's a whole new version number of the web that's warranted. Mm-hmm. So I was fairly skeptical. I was maybe a little bit jaundiced by that point about the claims that technology companies make about how big a deal they are and how revolutionary mm-hmm. Their offerings are. So I wanted to look around at the Web 2.0 universe, and pretty quickly as I did so, I became convinced that this actually was not hype. There was something new going on here. That new version number was actually warranted, and there was something really powerful taking place. But more to the point for my work, I thought there was something powerful taking place for organizations. In other words, not if you're trying to make a lot of money on the web or be an entrepreneur, but if you're just inside a decent-sized organization trying to make it run better, these same tools and approaches and philosophies that we saw on Web 2.0 were going to be really, really valuable to you. And the best quote I ever heard to summarize why they can be so valuable comes from Lou Platt, who was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard. He said, if only HP knew what HP knows, we'd be three times as productive. Just this beautiful summary of the problem that we know there are these pockets of expertise and knowledge and willingness to help all mm-hmm. scattered throughout our organizations, and they're not doing a good job right now of finding each other. And I came to believe that the technologies available to help with that problem had gone from lousy to fantastic in a very short space of time in the 2.0 era. So that's where the book came from.
So if you could specifically tell us what some of these tools are that make up Web 2.0.
Let me tell you instead what they all have in common. So we can rattle off what a bunch of the tools are. They're social networking software like Facebook or its equivalents. They're microblogging tools like Twitter and Yammer. They are blogging tools. They're tools for wikis. So there's this nice technology basket out there. When I looked at them, though, I was really struck by how much they all had in common as opposed to how different they all were. And they're all examples of what I call emergent social software platforms. And the key word there is emergent, which means that even though we don't define how these things are going to be used or who gets to do what, or we don't try to set the ground rules in advance, and we let people show up and basically do whatever they want, what we wind up with is not chaos. We wind up with really well-understood, orderly environments where we can search and navigate and find stuff.
And how are these tools in Web 2.0 different than what we experienced with the internet, you know, from its infancy up until this point?
There are about three big differences between the 1.0 and the 2.0 era. The first one was that we opened the doors to all comers with 2.0. In other words, Web 1.0 was fantastic, profoundly important technology, but you needed to have some level of technical expertise to put a website together, mm-hmm. and you needed some minimum level of investment. And in the 2.0 era, you need no expertise, no technical chops, and no money to start contributing just about as much content as you want of any variety up on the web.
And just to expand on that for a minute, it almost seems like these tools are giant microphones for people who want their voice to be heard.
And people who before had no opportunity to get their voice out there, let alone get their voice out there instantaneously worldwide. So mm-hmm. that's the first change, and mm-hmm. it's a very big deal. The second change was that as the 2.0 technologists were rolling out these platforms, they threw away the rule book. In other words, they stopped saying in advance, okay, here's the workflow, here's what you can do and you can't do, here is the org chart for this, here are the roles and responsibilities, and they just set up these digital sandboxes or playgrounds mm-hmm. that were initially very, very egalitarian, very democratic. So we let everyone come, and then we threw out the rule book about what they could do when they got there. That sounds like a recipe for chaos. And there is a great quote in the first wave of the internet, Internet 1.0. Someone said, the internet is the world's largest library. The problem is all the books are on the floor. In other words, there's this amazing content out there, but you have to get very lucky to find it. So the third big change that the 2.0 technologies brought us was to design environments where even after we invite all comers and we throw out the rule book, we wind up not with chaos, but with these very tightly defined, precisely defined environments that have this great geodesic dome kind of property where the bigger they get, the stronger they get, and the easier it is to get what you want.
On that third point, with the emergence of the first two, how does that result in the third point of tight environments, where point number two was throw away all the rules?
It's totally counterintuitive, right?
How does that happen?
It's an amazing phenomenon. We really weren't anticipating it. And the best example I can give of how it comes about is to talk about where Google came from. And most of us can find what we want on the web by doing some very quick searching around on Google. Most mm-hmm. of us walk away happy from our web searching. Mm-hmm. Back in Internet 1.0, that was not the case. And a lot of us who were around back then prided ourselves on our ability to do these very elaborate queries using Lycos and AltaVista and those old search engines. Mm-hmm. And we had tons of parentheses and ands and ors and nots. And now everyone just goes to Google, types in the first three words that occur to them, and they get back with useful search results. So this is a weird phenomenon. The Google co-founders were both computer science graduate students mm-hmm. at Stanford. And when you're a graduate student in the sciences, you read a lot of papers. And what makes a scientific paper good? It's the number of other papers that reference it. In other words, it's not how long it is or how inherently beautiful it is. It's how many other people say that's an important piece of work. The Google founders realized the web works exactly the same way. And when we link to each other's pages, we are not only telling the world what that page is about, but we're giving it a vote as well.
It's an endorsement.
It's an endorsement. It's a citation index. It's this very, very fine-grained structure for what the web is about. It's also very hard to game, so the spammers and the bad guys have trouble cracking that. And so we've developed a lot of these neat technical mechanisms to let the structure emerge, even though we don't define the structure up front.
And when you were talking about the scientific papers, as you were explaining it and how it was deemed credible, in my mind I was thinking that sounds a lot like a retweet.
It's exactly right. So when we retweet, we are giving a vote about this was a valuable contribution to the Twitterverse. Mm-hmm. It turns out that about 20% of tweets include a link, and almost 60% of retweets include a link. Okay. So we want to pass around these useful nuggets to each other.
Now, I have a question for you about what makes an effective tweet. What is it that makes a tweet effective and accomplishes its mission? What needs to be associated with it? I know a lot of things like picture and video help and whatnot, and links and things like that. Explain about the communication strategies to making things effective on 2.0.
The best advice I ever got about how to be heard in this 2.0 world where there are so many voices mm-hmm. is be remarkable. In other words, do something that other people want to refer to. And as far as I can tell, the two best ground rules for that in Twitter, in that specific environment, are first of all, point to something. So include a photo, include a link to a page, include an audio clip, or put a link in your tweet. Mm-hmm. And second of all, editorialize about it a little bit. Tell people why you find it noteworthy. Give it a vote. Now, that can be tough to do in 140 characters, but if you're disciplined about it, it's actually surprising how much information you can convey.
Sure, and that leads me to, I think, maybe where your book was going. And how do you do that in a company standing from maybe the standpoint of a federal agency or something like that, where you want to editorialize to make it effective, but you also have to play within some boundaries and some rules and going down that road?
Sure, and that's exactly right. We cannot throw out all the things that we know and that we believe about working inside an organization. Mm-hmm. This is not anarchy that we're proposing here. Right. So a lot of organizations that I've worked with try too hard up front to write very elaborate policy documents about here's how to blog, here's how to tweet, here's how to participate in social media and 2.0 environments. Mm-hmm. And I think that very often that 20-page statement about blogging policy can be reduced down to one sentence, which is, we'd prefer if you didn't blog. They just come across that way to the users. When I've looked at what successful organizations do, they do a lot more trusting of their employees mm-hmm. because by this time, people know how to behave in their jobs. They know what's appropriate. They know what's inappropriate behavior. And if they really wanted to post hate speech or harass a coworker, they weren't waiting around for 2.0 technologies to do that. They had plenty of opportunities to misbehave before. So I advocate basically putting out the lightest possible policy statements up front, the fewest upfront guidelines, and trusting your people. Over and over, we've seen that people respond beautifully to this, and my collection of horror stories is just about empty.
Yeah, it's you hear the random story here and there about someone who got in trouble at the workplace because of something they put on Facebook or Twitter or something like that. But it seems like, one, technology is coming one way or the other. Whether you choose to embrace it or not, it's coming. So it's going to be part of our lives,
yep.
These types of things. And two, the tool that was used to communicate that message was simply that. It was a tool.
It wasn't
forced upon anyone to say anything in particular. It was just the tool that opinion came out on.
And if someone picked up the phone and leaked out sensitive information or blabbed inappropriately, mm-hmm. no one would advocate ripping out the phone network. So I think your distinction is really important there. I also think it's really telling that a lot of government agencies, like the DOD, for example, have explicitly embraced these technologies and said to warfighters, for example, you can go ahead and use 2.0 technologies. You cannot give away troop movements, just like you couldn't in the old world.
Right.
But if you want to update your Facebook status, that's fine.
And let me ask you a question about when we're using these tools, the tone that we communicate. Is the expectation to remain, I don't know if rigid is the right word, or more proper, or are we supposed to be more relaxed on these tools and how we communicate?
It's a great question, and there is a huge range of opinion on this. Mm-hmm. I just found it really interesting. In the New York Times Magazine yesterday, there was a long article about two fairly junior staffers in the State Department mm-hmm. who are prolific users of a lot of these social technologies. Mm-hmm. And these guys are tweeting on behalf of the government, so they're putting out tweets, but they've adopted a more relaxed tone. So they will tweet both about Secretary of State Clinton's itinerary, who she's meeting, and the guy says, for example, I'm going to Twitter headquarters, I'm really excited, or I'm going to go to the Inception movie premiere tonight, and mm-hmm. that's really cool. So they're adopting this mix of very formal, fact-based information, and then some opinion, some personalized stuff. I find that great. It helps people connect.
And don't you think that those are little pieces of information that, while they're not any sort of threat to national security or the mission or anything like that, it's interesting to know that someone is accompanying the Secretary of State to a lunch, or, you know, talked about something that you wouldn't necessarily find in a press release or on a television interview.
I agree with that, and I think increasingly we're moving into an era where people expect that level, some level of humanization going on. In other words, we're kind of tired of getting bombarded by these anonymous press releases that felt like they were written by a robot, and there's no soul, there's no life to them at all. What we're seeing with these 2.0 technologies is the opportunity to communicate a very different, much more personal tone, and people respond to that. And I'm with you. I don't think it compromises the mission of the organization.
You would think if one uses general common sense and remains within the boundaries of their employment, that a little bit of freedom to operate is good.
I believe it is. We are negotiating these boundaries. This
sure.
is a new world. It's still a little bit fuzzy.
Mm-hmm.
So when does it get too personal? When does it get inappropriate?
Right.
We'll hammer these things out, and there will be missteps. We absolutely know that.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, a philosophy of trusting your people and embracing this trend is a much smarter philosophy than trying to stop the tide, because you can't.
It's coming one way or the other.
Yep.
And it seems like what you're suggesting would also lead to people feeling like they can take ownership over their work, and they're proud in what they're doing. And if they have that freedom and flexibility to move around a little bit, and they know that their managers or whomever trust them, and they continue to make good decisions, they should be able to continue doing that.
And they should be rewarded for that.
Sure.
And in particular, a couple other neat things can happen. Your expertise can become more visible throughout the organization, even a very big organization. And one of the huge problems for any decent-sized organization is knowing who knows what. And historically, that's been a nasty challenge. It's getting easier now. Another great phenomenon that can take place is that you can be helpful to someone who sits way on the other side of the country. You've never met them before, but they float a question up using these 2.0 technologies. You can reach out and help them put hours back in their week, introduce them to someone they really need to know, and we can activate our altruism in some novel and really exciting ways.
And there's no real border to that. You can go anywhere. You can be anything.
Yeah, and we are essentially wired to be helpful to each other. We are an altruistic species at some level, especially if it doesn't cost us very much. And one of the neat things these technologies do is lower the barriers to altruism. So with Twitter, for example, it's the work of, what, 15, 30 seconds to compose an answer back to somebody and throw it back out there across the Twitterverse. Why would you not do that?
Andrew McAfee, author of Enterprise 2.0, New Collaborative Tools for Your Organization's Toughest Challenges. We're about out of time. We appreciate you coming on, but I just want to get one more thing from you. If people want to check out your book or learn a little bit more about you, do you have a website or anything that they can use to contact you?
Yep, two things. My Twitter handle is A. McAfee, A-M-C-A-F-E-E. And my website is andrewmcafee.org. And I think if you do a little Googling around, you can find that pretty easily.
Looking forward to it. We'll certainly connect with you online. And thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Are you an AFGE member who loves the great outdoors? Then the AFGE Union Sportsmen's Alliance benefit is perfect for you. Whether it's fins, furs, or feathers that calls you, the Union Sportsmen's Alliance has you covered. This unique benefit is a community of hunters and fishermen who share the Union Brotherhood. That's right, an exclusive hunting and fishing club by and for Union members, retirees, and their families. Your $25 membership gets you money-saving discounts on great outdoor gear and services, a free MyTop Topo.com online mapping subscription, a one-year subscription to a top outdoor magazine, and a $25 gift certificate for Beretta field gear. You'll also receive a subscription to the Union Sportsman's Journal. To learn more about this exciting benefit, please visit the member benefits page at afge.org or call us at 877-872-2211. That's 877-872-2211. Join today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Perry Hooks, president of Hooks Book Events here at the Excellence in Government Conference. Perry, welcome back to the program.
Hello, hello, Jason. Good to see you again.
Always good to have you on the program. Of course, you supplied the luncheon keynote speaker for today. That was Andrew McAfee, and you also have your hand in a number of other projects. Why don't you start off by telling us about some of those?
All right. Well, I do want to tell you that I've been spending some time recently in the last month and a half with Sebastian Unger. Sebastian is a writer for Vanity Fair. Probably many people out there have read or seen the movie The Perfect Storm. We took Sebastian to several events, one at a private large corporation, but his book is about the Afghan War. And I'm bringing this up because I think there are a lot of DOD people out there who are involved in what's going on in Afghanistan and Iraq. And Sebastian was in Afghanistan for 5 months writing a book called War and also filming a documentary called Restrepo that's just out here in Washington at the E Street Theater. And I'm just telling folks about it because I think it's important for all Americans to understand the stressors of war, the boredom of war, and what is really going on over there with our soldiers that we are sending there and then bringing them home. And I just think it's a great book, and I just wanted to put a little plug in there for Sebastian's book and movie.
I'm wondering if you can maybe tell us a little bit more about that. I know, obviously, at AFGE, we're very concerned about our nation's veterans and a lot of people who come home from war. And they have signs of PTSD,
yes.
And they undergo things that no one else can really experience. We all have stressors in
yes.
life, but nothing really compares to fearing for your life on a daily basis.
You're exactly right. And that's really, Tim Hetherington is the other guy who helped with the movie, and Sebastian wrote the book. But that's exactly what they're trying to relay. What is life like in an outpost with 15 to 20 guys being shot at in 1 year over 500 times? That's more than one time a day. At one point in 2008, this was the most dangerous place in the world to be, the Korangal Valley. Sebastian lived with the boys for 5 months at a time. He would come in for a month and did that five times, and so did Tim. This is not a political book. It is not a political film. It is important for Americans to see what these guys are going through, so when they come home and integrating back into reality with their families, their wives, their children, it's really hard to go to Walmart when you've been shot at the week before. So this really shows it. Matter of fact, when I saw the film, I thought this could be the Persian War 2,000 years ago. War is war. Men in a small outpost experience similar things. And he named the three chapters Fear, Killing, and Love. And he describes the fear, the killing, and the love, and the brotherhood that these boys feel. And then they come home, and we're trying to reintegrate them into society, and it's hard to do. So I think seeing the film will give them, the American people, a chance to see what life is like, and reading the book as well. I really recommend it.
How do we go about meeting the needs of those who return from war, experiencing things that we really just can't fathom?
Well, I think the VA, Walter Reed, I do a small sort of series at Walter Reed. I think they're doing the best they can, and I think they're trying really hard to understand PTSD. I believe last week they've got new insurance around what's going on with PTSD. They're much more open about discussing it. I think the boys are realizing it's not a stigma to talk about it. It is stressful. It is scary. I mean, I would even tell you, I think the writers, Sebastian and Tim, would tell you, I think they were changed, but they didn't even carry a gun. They were journalists. They had cameras and paper. But they were moved by this. They were impacted by it. You can't help but be. I think bringing it out in the open, reading the book, seeing the movie, and giving the boys space to talk about what they went through so they can process it is great. Many of the boys are just saying, you want to know what I went through? Go see the movie. Go read the book.
We'll certainly have to check that out. It's something I think probably that a lot of people would be interested to see.
It's here at Landmark East Street Cinema downtown in the book War by Sebastian. You can get anywhere. But if you want to shop at a good independent bookstore, I'm all for that.
Something else going on at Hook's Book Events is an initiative called Deepen the Conversation, and I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that and what's behind it.
Well, Jason, I've been doing this work with Uncle Sam for about 10 years now, and it's been great. I love bringing in Nobel laureates, Pulitzer Prize winners, really thought leaders on all the topics that are impacting the government and trying to find solutions. But these are two-hour events. The SESers and the other folks see these writers, hear these writers, and then they leave the room. I've been wondering for 10 years what happens. Where does the information go? Does it go deeper into the organizations? Do other people coming up, the leadership, the emerging leadership, are they getting the same information? So we connected with a wonderful software company called iCohere, which is based in Silicon Valley. They are already doing these online-type workshops, and we call it Deepen the Conversation because we would love to see the conversations that we start on these in-person events with people like Sri Kumar Rao, Seth Kahn, Steve Denning, take it deeper into an organization where you can have live chat with the writers, email input, pre-taped videos of the content of the book, really a four-week online in-depth conversation, Ed, to change behavior in your workplace. So we're calling it Deepen the Conversation. You can find us at hooksbookevents.com or deepentheconversation.com. And we're going to try and see if we can get some government folks taking this information deeper into their organization for real transformation.
And did you find that people were saying to you, hey, we love the presentations during the day. How can we get more out of it?
Well, it's exactly where it's in. What I notice is at the book signing table, that is where individuals will come up. They ask the question they really wanted to ask in front of people. They hand business cards out. My writers, 9 out of 10 of them, get emails from these federal employees for weeks after the event. How can I do this? This is a great idea. What do you think about this idea? They want extended conversation. They're really hors d'oeuvres. The book events are essentially hors d'oeuvres. They want a meal. They want to take it deeper. They want to know, this is a great idea, Seth and Steve. How can we make radical management happen in our organization? How can we make change happen? This way, for a very low price, we have a very inexpensive workshop price for U.S. government. You get a signed copy of the book, an additional copy of the book. You get access, emails, personal live interaction with these guys for 4 weeks. It's excellent.
It's almost like a little bit of a bonus. Once you get that initial sort of whets your appetite, and then you can follow up with it online.
Yeah, and you get emails. You can contact with them. If 10 or more folks from an agency want to have it their own private chat room, we can set that up too. So you can talk, how would this work at Homeland? How would this work at IRS? How can we make radical management happen in my agency? Let's get 10 of us together and see if we can do it.
Now, that sounds a little bit like some Web 2.0, if I'm not mistaken.
It is. It fits right in with what Andy is saying.
And, uh-huh.
Yeah, Andy McAfee, they're really going to have a real earful today at lunch with Andy's conversation. We took Andy... We about wore him out in January. He was here. We took him to like 3 or 4 agencies, and they just loved him. Breaking down those silos, getting conversations going interagency and within agencies is critical for this government to move forward.
Absolutely, especially because today the entire conference is dedicated to an openness
right,
in government.
Right.
And
he's your man. He's your man.
If we're going to be open in government, we need to have some tools around us that allows us to have this free flow of information.
Absolutely.
And data sharing.
And it's less expensive. I mean, online, it's fairly inexpensive to do these workshops online.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
We'd love for folks out there to check out deepentheconversation.com. Mm-hmm. And right. If you have questions, let me know.
So you mentioned previously Seth and Steve. Tell us a little bit about Seth and Steve and who they are and what's going on.
Well, Seth and Steve, many people around here know them. They got their start together at the World Bank. Seth's book is called Getting Change Right. Steve Denning is a well-known storyteller around town. He's actually quite a famous storyteller. Mm-hmm. And I think they use aspects of storytelling to get their points across because everybody loves a story, and that's a great way to relay information is through storytelling. So they're combining their efforts with their books, The Leader's Guide to Radical Management, which is Steve's new book, and Getting Change Right. And they're going to do this together with Deepen the Conversation and talk about how to make radical management happen. They met at the World Bank. They took these two ideas and actually got it to work at the World Bank. Their initiative at the World Bank is still going full bore. They've subsequently left the World Bank and have started their own consulting businesses. But they're having lots of luck in the U.S. government. The government is very interested in this because they're give you very practical, hands-on ways to make change happen.
I'm interested in the title of Seth's book, Getting Change Right. Can you tell us a little bit about what exactly he's referring to?
Well, he had to implement something new at the World Bank, and it was change, and no one wanted to do it, and they had a hard time doing it. And this book is extremely practical. It's very deliberate. You need to do this, A, B, C, and D. It is not just theory. It is practical advice. He did it at the World Bank. He knows it works. I highly recommend the book, Getting Change Right by Seth Kahn.
I would think that's a refreshing perspective for people to get some very clear suggestions, not just a 30,000-foot view.
It's
but
not.
You drill down into the weeds.
It's in the weeds. It's on the ground, boots on the ground, how to do it, both of these guys. And they're both storytellers, so they're engaging. So in person, they're great. We're taking them to a lot of in-person events with the U.S. government, and then you can hear them deeper and go deeper with this idea with Deepen the Conversation.
I know that's not the only thing going on with you. Of course, you're probably gearing up for a busy rest of the summer and then into the fall. Tell us about some of the events that you have coming up.
I've got 9 this week, believe it or not, and my fabulous business partner
this
is
week,
out of town.
Some people don't have 9 events in a month.
I know. This is Hook's Book Events, honey. We are busy. I've got Jillian Tett of the Financial Times for 3 events in one day, starting with U.S. Treasury on Thursday. She is a brilliant English woman who has actually studied as an anthropologist. She studied Tajik goat herders in Tajikistan, which is where you'll find Tajik goat herders. There are not many around here. And she
Not inside the Beltway.
No, not many goat herders. But she began to see that goat herders and bond traders have a lot in common. And as I'm an alum of a bond desk, I can agree with that. So her book, Fool's Gold, is a marvelous sort of bird's eye view of what happened in the financial crisis. And she's brilliant and engaging, and she's an anthropologist. So I think many people are going to enjoy her. I highly recommend Fool's Gold if you're still confused about what happened in the financial crisis, check out Jillian's book. She's wonderful. We've got Richard Clark with Cyber War coming up with 2 private events. We're very excited about that. Clearly, it's a big issue with the government, cybersecurity, cyber warfare. So we're immensely excited to be working with Richard Clark on cyber war. I highly recommend folks looking at that. We've got some great history books. A lot of these agencies like to look at history and teaching leadership through history. Some new books out on the Supreme Court, something on Thomas Jefferson from Michael Cranish. Leadership and history go hand in hand. It's a great way to teach leadership. It's looking what some American, historical figures did well and what they didn't do so well. Let's see what else we've got going on. Oh, I really am excited about Isabel Wilkerson coming in September for The Warmth of Other Suns, chronicling the American migration of the African-American population. She is the first African-American female journalist to get a Pulitzer Prize. I'm very excited about Isabel Wilkerson, and we're taking her to the U.S. Treasury in September. So we're gearing up for a very, very busy fall, and we'll be back here in November.
Now, if people want to learn more about these events and the others that you have scheduled, where can they find you?
They can find me on the radio with you or on the web at hooksbookevents.com.
Perry Hooks, president of Hooks Book Events, thanks so much for your time.
Awesome. Good to see you.
Thank you to our guests this week, Merit System Protections Board Chairman Susan Grundman, AFGE 6th District National Vice President Arnold Scott, author Andrew McAfee, and Hooks Book Events President Perry Hooks. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power.